From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
North Oakland. Temescal.
Alamo Square.
I live in Noe Valley.
Corona Heights. Western
Addition. I live in North Oakland, right by MacArthur BART Station.
Coming up, another dispatch from the San Quentin Prison Report tells us about restorative justice. We'll learn how dialogue between victims and offenders can sometimes lead to healing.
I've always wondered what forgiveness would look like.
We'll hear from offenders and victims of violent crime.
Knowing that he heard my words, that was really enough to give me so much healing.
And then we'll meet a man from the Bayview who's helping other men be the best fathers they can be.
If I understand what I really value in my life, then that means I value the future of any child that I bring into the world.
Family and forgiveness coming up today on Cross Currents. California has been dealing with overcrowding in its prisons for years, and it's far from over. 2 weeks ago, federal judges granted the state an extension on a looming deadline to reduce the prison population or face the mandatory release of 8,000 inmates come January 27, 2014. This is just the latest development in a case that's been making its way through the courts since 2008, centered around inadequate medical care for inmates. The state has been ordered to reduce its prison population down to about 140% of capacity. It's now closer to 160%. But those numbers do little to reflect the actual stories of what's going on inside of the state's prison system for the men and women who are still there, about 134,000 people. That's why KALW is working with the San Quentin Prison Report to bring you real stories about life behind bars in radio pieces produced by inmates themselves.
The San Quentin Prison Report.
SQPR is a media collective of prisoners and volunteers from the community working together to give voice to personal growth, social transformation, and restorative justice.
SQPR.
Our mission is to create documentaries, films, and audio programs that broaden and challenge the conversation around crime, punishment, and rehabilitation in the United States.
A single crime can take place in a matter of seconds, but its effects can last a lifetime for victims, offenders, and also the wider community. The formal justice system usually doesn't address that aspect, but the restorative justice approach seeks healing for everyone affected by a crime. Often, it's through a practice called victim-offender dialogue. Today, we'll hear about the transformative effect this practice had on a man currently serving time in San Quentin. Tommy Shakur Ross will tell you that story. But a note for our listeners, the media lab at San Quentin is in the old laundry facility, and every so often the rusty pipes make noises that you'll hear. Here's Tommy Shakur Ross.
Recently, a prisoner named Kairi met with the sister of a man he murdered 23 years ago. In restorative justice terms, this is known as victim-offender dialogue. He expresses how he felt just moments before their meeting.
I just really didn't know what it was going to look like, so therefore it was a lot of fear, it was a lot of anxiety, uncertainty.
Victim-offender dialogue is a process that brings the victim and the offender together to talk about the crime.
Once I got in there and I reached over the table to shake her hand, I knew that this was going to be a real nice dialogue. One of the most profound thing that I was really feeling was that I didn't want to go in and re-injure her.
In 1990, Kairi was arrested, convicted of first-degree murder, and sentenced to 26 years to life. At San Quentin, he involved himself in a restorative justice program called Victim Offender Education Group. He says this program helped him to prepare for the dialogue with the victim's sister.
I wasn't aware of the impact that I was causing to her family, and not just to her family, but the community at large. So when you sit across from someone that you've harmed, you're going to hear from them personally what that effect was and how that affected their lives. Initially, she and I broke out and we just cried.
Kairi also learned some things about the murder victim of his crime that he hadn't known prior to talking with her.
He was 42 years old at the time. I didn't know that. I didn't know that he flew airplanes. I didn't know that. I didn't know that his father had died like a year, like a week and a half before I murdered him.
Victim offender dialogue is based on the principles of restorative justice, which emphasizes accountability, empathy, and amends. It places the people impacted by crime at its center. In this instance, she wanted to know why he killed her brother. She wanted answers.
She wanted to know, who was I before I murdered her brother? What my life was like? She asked me what happened on the day that I murdered her brother. And she went on for the third question, was that, who am I today?
Kyrie told the victim that he was an addict and spent 10 years chasing drugs, that he had built up a lot of anger, despair, and rage because he had become an addict. He also told her more about the gruesome details of the murder, but out of respect to the victim, we won't discuss that here. At the end, Kyrie began to tell her where he is in his life today.
The programs and everything that I've been involved in since I've been here at San Quentin has given me an opportunity to really take a look at my life.
Kyrie is a certified drug counselor and has been a participant and facilitator in a number of self-help and rehabilitative groups that focus on addiction recovery counseling and restorative justice themes.
In order for restorative justice to actually work, the offender and the victim needs to be a part of the process so that some understanding on both sides could really come to some full understanding of what this feels like, what this looks like, and what we can do to bridge that gap or to repair the injuries.
The amends process can start by asking how, if possible, can the victim be made whole again. Shortly after their meeting, Kyrie wrote the victim a thank you letter to thank her for having the courage to come and meet with him. And she wrote him back, expressing her feelings and what it felt like for her.
Dear Kyrie, although it has been 5 months since I met with you, I have thought often since then of our encounter. When I received your letter of thanks, I was very moved by your honesty and by learning that our meeting has helped you in your healing process. I determined at that time that I also wanted to write a letter of thanks to you, but I needed more time to understand my feelings. I will tell you that our meeting was one of the most profound encounters of my life. Why? Because both of us were speaking from a very vulnerable place in ourselves, a place at the essence of whom we each are. Most daily encounters are not that way.
Kyrie shares how he felt after reading her letter for the first time.
I broke down in tears because when I wrote my letter of thank you for her being a part of this dialogue, I wasn't really sure in my mind how she had felt. So knowing that I was able to give her what she needed from me, that really, really made a big difference.
Apparently, the dialogue profoundly impacted both Kyrie and the victim in a powerful way. It set them on a path towards healing, honor, and validation.
I've always wondered what forgiveness would look like. I know that in that process, it's a hard thing. It was a hard thing to ask for forgiveness because I was living with so much shame, you know, so much anger towards myself. In her response, she said, "Kyrie, I forgive you."
Some victims who choose forgiveness can experience a deep sense of healing, but some victims may not want to ever be bothered or heard from by an offender. Just remember, if people can harm, people can heal. If people can harm, people can also help and serve. At its core, one can see the inner relationship between all of our actions and their effects, good, bad, or indifferent. I'm Tommy Shakur Ross with the San Quentin Prison Report. I'm out.
The San Quentin Prison Report is a partnership with KALW to bring stories from inside of California's oldest prison to the public radio airwaves. Tune in next week for another report from San Quentin. We'll learn about the unexpected challenges of getting out of prison after living behind bars for 29 years.
Being able to trust people, that is something I had been struggling with for quite some time, and I took that from my childhood out there in here, and to be honest with you, I'm still struggling with that right now today.
That's next Monday on Cross Currents.
The San Quentin Prison Report is produced by Founding Director Troy Williams and Managing Director Nigel Poor. The SQPR production team includes reporters Tommy Shakur Ross, Shawala Stepter, Greg Eskridge, and production assistant Shireen Garcia. SQPR is made possible by the support of Warden Kevin Chappelle, Public Information Officer Lieutenant Sam Robinson, TV Specialist Larry Schneider, and KALW News Director Holly Kernan.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan. We just heard how restorative justice changed inmate Kyrie's life, but how can the victims of a violent crime benefit from that process as well? For Dionne Wilson, it wasn't until 7 years after her husband, a San Leandro police officer, was killed in the line of duty.
For many years, I carried around so much vengeance and hate, and I realized at a certain point, I had nothing left. I had no more tools. I engaged in a lot of self-destructive behavior. I tried to buy my way out of my grief. I tried to drink my way out for a short period. Thankfully, I didn't take that too far. And I just didn't have a way to move past being embroiled in that moment.
Dionne initially thought the trial and conviction of her husband's murderer would bring her some sort of comfort or closure.
I had this little light at the end of the tunnel, and I kept thinking, it's almost over. He's going to get convicted. He's going to be on death row. I'm going to feel better. And then when it happened and he did get put on death row, I waited and I waited and I waited, and I went, huh, wow, it really didn't work. I don't feel better. I feel worse. Because now I'm let down. Now this promise of making it right within our current system, it completely let me down. And so I realized that the only way out of it was a different route. I didn't know exactly what that was, but that's kind of a long story.
And it took a long time. Dionne decided to try restorative justice. She got counseling to prepare her to meet a murderer, someone like the man who killed her husband. In Dionne's case, she couldn't actually confront the true offender because he's on death row and appealing his conviction. So Dionne met what's called a surrogate, and she says that helped her begin her healing process. After meeting the surrogate face-to-face, talking about redemption, justice, and the searing pain of loss, Wilson finally felt ready to send a letter to the man who killed her husband.
And it took me 9 months to get it to him. And it took a lot of work, a lot of searching, a lot of phone calls, a lot of begging and pleading. And I finally was put in contact with his attorney, who is a wonderful woman. And it actually took me a couple of hours of phone conversations to convince her that I didn't have any ulterior motives, that I wasn't trying to cause further harm. Knowing that he heard my words, that was really enough to give me so much healing. It was amazing the effect that it had on me and my life. What I'd really want to say to him is to not give up on the life that he has right now, because I know that, you know, when you're sitting in a cage and you know you're going to die there, there's no question, you're going to die there one way or another, that it's really easy to lose hope and think that there's no possible way you can have a positive effect on the world. But I don't believe that. I believe that he can.
Restorative justice invites a fundamental shift in how we do and think about justice.
Sonia Shaw is advocacy director of the Insight Prison Project, which facilitates restorative justice meetings like the one Dion says changed her life.
In that process, what's missing is nobody actually asks me as a person who's committed a crime what I've done, and nobody actually really, really gives me an opportunity to take accountability. And on the side of a survivor, the victim of a crime, nobody asks that victim what they need, what the impact of the harm was, and actually, what does a victim think that the obligation is on the side of the person that's committed the harm? Victims are just used often to convict. So restorative justice basically invites a very different process of repairing harm. It takes into account crime survivors' needs, community safety, public safety, you mentioned that, accountability, and really actually getting to the root causes of harm.
The Insight Prison Project works with two restorative practices, victim-offender dialogue and restorative group conferencing. The victim-offender dialogue is where, after working with separate facilitators for months, sometimes for years, victims and offenders will come together and talk about what happened. Sometimes the victim is actually talking to the perpetrator of the crime, and sometimes they speak to surrogates, like Dion Wilson did. Dion now goes to different prisons to facilitate victim-offender dialogue.
I had the opportunity to go to the women's prison at Chowchilla and speak with a couple different groups of women who were in there for murder. And the level of accountability that I saw those ladies taking for what they had done was amazing to me, because there are things that I've done in my life and I know they were wrong. But I didn't even know how to begin to take that kind of accountability. They were honest. It was heartfelt. They wanted so desperately to be able to sit across from the people that they hurt and acknowledge them. And what the amazing thing that IPP does is that it allows the connection of the crime and the humanity of the person that they've hurt. That is the key to actually having people transform their lives.
But before an offender can participate in the restorative justice process, they have to accept accountability for their crime. Again, Sonia Shaw.
And there's a basic kind of connection between violence and trauma, so that if your trauma goes unprocessed, that there is a tendency to either act inwards and hurt yourself. So that's the substance abuse, that's the cutting, suicide. And the other is the acting outwards and hurting other people. So when the men inside start to look at their past hurts and go, oh, ding, 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 this is what happened to me, and then this is how I felt, and then this is how I acted as a result, and you start to see this ricochet effect, they start to connect the dots of their lives that led to the crime. Mm-hmm. And it's like a picture that gets painted.
This program is not a hug-a-thug fest. This is real transformation that's taking place with people, and they are facilitating the things that will reduce the real drivers of crime.
Researchers are studying the impact restorative justice programs have on recidivism rates. Shaw says this alternative approach to justice can lead to positive results outside prison walls.
The effect on public safety is much, much lower recidivism, much, much lower. Much lower crime as well. So if you have, the outcomes are much higher. So if you have people who are going through a process where they're actually repairing the harm, and that's actually happening now in Oakland as well. They're doing that same model in Oakland, and they're doing it in San Francisco.
Today, Dion Wilson works as the Survivor Outreach Coordinator for Californians for Safety and Justice, a nonprofit that reaches out to communities and survivors of crime who want to address its root causes.
So I just wanted to say that in case people have the impression that this movement is happening in a vacuum, it absolutely is not. Californians for Safety and Justice put out the first ever crime victim survey asking crime victims what they want, what they prefer. And we have a report that's out. And one of the questions was, do you think that California should invest more in health services like mental health and drug and alcohol treatment, or invest more in jails and prisons? And 74% of people responded that they want health services, drug treatment.
You can find more information about restorative justice at our website. It's kalw.org. And if you've participated in restorative justice practices, let us know what it was like for you. You can just leave us a message at 415-264-7106. Again, that number to tell us about your experience with restorative justice is 415-264-7106. You can also post on our Facebook page. We are KALW. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. We'll go now to San Francisco's Bayview neighborhood to meet James Martin. About 10 years ago, on a Thursday night, Martin had just arrived home when the deafening sound of gunshots rang out. He looked out the window and saw a young man laying on the ground. Troubled by the senseless loss of another life in his neighborhood, he decided he had to do something. That following Sunday, he put on a suit, grabbed his portable karaoke machine, went to the sidewalk memorial erected for the young man, and James Martin began singing.
I began singing, "Wake up, everybody. No more sleeping in bed. No more backward thinking, time for thinking ahead."
He did this to draw attention to the violence plaguing his neighborhood. Today, Martin is still standing up for San Francisco's Bayview. Recently, he called on Bayview fathers to walk their children to school, then march to the Bayview Opera House for a rally.
We're here in commitment to our children, and we're here in commitment to our communities. Y'all make some noise about that. Yeah.
Martin's main focus now is helping men stay involved in their children's lives and their community. Reporter Laura Flynn followed Martin around for a few days to find out how he does it.
James Martin is originally from Detroit, but his family arrived in Bayview in 1959. His father was a bus driver and moved the family out west as the Detroit transit system was shrinking and San Francisco's growing.
He said, "You guys, when you come out here, we're going to live on a big house on a hill overlooking the ocean." And I said, you know, I tell people he was not totally wrong. We lived on a big hill in the projects overlooking the bay.
Martin was 8 when he, his mom, and 6 siblings moved into the Hunters Point housing project.
It was a very, very beautiful area. I mean, the grounds were kept very nicely and very neatly.
Then the money dried up, the gardener was gone, and it changed.
I'll always remember my friends and I, you know, picking out those of our friends who we thought were the rich ones in the environment. I believe that our perception was those households that had a father in the family who had a car and a job, we felt like they were the wealthy ones.
Was your father not there?
Well, yeah, after Dad got us here from Detroit, unfortunately, but he was gone. We got here in 59, and by 61, he was gone into another life. So Mom spent the rest of that time raising us.
As Martin was growing up, he noticed how much more civically active women were in the neighborhood, fighting to bring dollars to the community, to fund programs, several that shaped who he is today. But throughout his life, he continued to ask this one question: where are the men? Then one day, on a school field trip to the phone company, an unexpected role model walked into his life.
And he was African American. He came down and he greeted us all at the door, a group of us kids.
The man was wearing a 3-piece suit.
And he said, "We're about to have an extraordinary experience that you all may not have seen or heard before."
The man took Martin and the group of students to the phone company's central office. Walking into the office, they hear click, 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 click.
And he was able to explain to us what the clicks were all about. He said, "Every time you hear one of these hundreds of clicks and thousands of clicks you're hearing, that means someone somewhere is taking the phone off the hook." And it was just amazing to us that he spoke so clearly, made us understand the depth of that technology at the time. I said 2 things to myself. I said, "I gotta get me one of those suits." Number one. And number two, I said, "This is the job I wanna do."
Martin got the suit and the job. He started off at the telephone company right out of high school. While there, he became the head of urban affairs. His job was to help the company address issues in mostly minority communities. Martin became the main liaison to the NAACP. One day, his home phone rang, and it was NAACP's then executive director, Dr. Benjamin Hooks, with an offer.
The regional director of the Western region of the NAACP, the same job that that gentleman in my high school had been in.
Martin says the next few years were sobering, dealing with a series of letter bombs, death threats, racial violence, white supremacists, police shootings. Then he received a letter from members of infamous Los Angeles gangs, the Crips and the Bloods, claiming inhumane conditions in the L.A. County Jail.
And they said, in essence, help us, NAACP. It's not that we don't belong in jail. We have done things that cause us to need to be in jail because we've broken the law. But what's going on inside here is not supposed to be happening to us or any human beings.
Martin's life was about to change again. With the team, he visited the jail.
And I went and I walked into that jail, and I could barely keep from crying myself. I remember then biting my tongue. And as far as I could see on all three tiers, there was a young black man. They got hope just seeing us there.
Martin says inmates reported horrendous conditions, including allegations of torture. While working to improve conditions for these men, Martin realized that they weren't the only ones being affected by their incarceration. These men left voids behind in their communities.
Right now, I can show you all kinds of documentation that talk about, you know, the implication of what happens in communities when the fathers are missing.
He saw a similar problem when he looked around his own neighborhood. Out of this came the Men and Fatherhood Service Program. James Martin started it on his own, but soon the local YMCA got interested and helped him with some funding. Martin says they try to help men manage their emotions, learn how to address relationship issues, and how to be a supportive parent. In the last 4 years, over 100 men have gone through the group. Aladdin Fagan relied on the group when his son was taken from his ex's custody 2 years ago.
During that process, I was made to do anger management classes, fatherhood classes, parenting classes. And a lot of times when things didn't go my way, I would have to bring myself into class, holding my heart in my hands.
After running the groups at the Bayview YMCA since 2009, Martin is retiring, but he's left a signature mark.
All right, okay, all right. One, two, three!
That's the man sound. Tonight, a room full of current and past participants, colleagues, and friends come together to say goodbye to Martin at his retirement party in the best way they know how.
So are you ready to do it again? Make sure with the neighborhood knows we're here? You ready? All right, we're going to do this. One, two, three! See, that's why we make a man sound, because we need to know people. We need people to know that we are here and that we're not going anywhere. And if we haven't been there, then we're going to get back to where we need to be.
Aladdin Fagan didn't just learn the man sound from Martin. He says Martin taught him how to be a man.
Because that's one thing a lot of us men never learned growing up, was how to be a man.
That was the same for Martin until he met the man in the three-piece suit. Now he's trying to be even more than a man in a suit to the men in his community. Though he's retiring from the Y, it's not quite the end. He plans to support building the infrastructure of the fatherhood program so it can continue without him and be replicated in other areas. And in the meantime, you might find him speaking at a rally, singing, or performing spoken word about love and brotherhood.
When you love a brother back, you love his family. You love your community. You love the little children that we all love to see. When you love a brother back, it's about us. It's about what we do. It's about who we are.
In Bayview, I'm Laura Flynn for Cross Currents.
Love a brother back. I love you, my brothers. Love me back.
Yeah.
That story was mixed by Stephanie Fu for the Sights and Sounds of Bayview Project, a collaboration between KALW and the San Francisco Arts Commission to tell the stories of people making a positive impact on San Francisco's Bayview neighborhood. It featured music by Third Street Productions, part of the Third Street Youth Clinic in Bayview. And that's it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. Our team includes Hana Baba, Julie Kane, Jen Chien, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Seth Samuel, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Nina Gensler-Debs, Liz Mack, Mary Reese, Daphne Matsiaraki, Stephen Short, and Rachel Wong. Today's show was engineered by Mr. Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our senior producer is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Also, thanks to you, KALW is independent, listener-supported public radio. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll be taking an in-depth look at the 911 emergency system in Oakland, and we'll try and figure out why African-American residents think it doesn't work the same for them.
What you want me to tell the ambulance driver if something happens?
That I'm white and that I need help and that I'm in distress and I look like I got a lot of money.
Tune in tomorrow for The Race to an Emergency, a special hour-long documentary from KALW News. You're listening to the longtime roots music fiddler, Tom Rigney. Rigney and his band Flambeau were voted best Cajun Zydeco band a few years back by the West Coast Hall of Fame. Tom Rigney and company will be performing tomorrow evening at Ashkenaz in Berkeley starting at 8:30 p.m. And if you're interested, there's a dance lesson starting at 8 p.m. For more information or to hear more local music, go to our website. It's kalw.org. That's also where you can subscribe to the Cross Currents podcast.
I could go out with guys, baby, left me high and dry. And I could use a pick-me-up and I could dance all night. Dance all night and never be blue.
And we'll leave you with another edition of my mixtape where people share songs that mean something special to them. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.
My name is Tania Pulido. I live in San Pablo. And the song I want to share with you is Changes from Tupac.
Come on.
I see no changes. Wake up in the morning and I ask myself, is life worth living? Should I blast myself? I'm tired of being poor.
I really like this song because I feel that it talks to a lot of the people I grew up with that deal with like gang violence and drugs and a lot of negativity, but I feel Tupac really speaks to the community I work in and live in because I feel it's really real and yeah, it speaks to me.
Unless we share with each other, we gotta start making changes. Learn to see me as a brother instead of two distant strangers. And that's how I was supposed to be. How can the devil take a brother if he's close to me? I let it go back to when we played as kids, but then it changed. That's the way it is. Come on.
That's just the way it is. Things will never be the same. That's just the way it is. Oh yeah,
damn, yeah.
Oh, come on. That's just the way it is. Things will never be the same.